From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, from the Black Panther Party to the Democratic Party, we talk with Bobby Rush, freshman congressman from Illinois. Rush co-founded the Illinois chapter of the Panther Party, devoted to self-help, equal rights, and revolution. Revolution is no longer on the agenda, but there are many connections between his work then and now. Also today, we remember lyricist Sammy Kahn, who died last week. His songs include All the Way, Come Fly With Me, I Fall in Love Too Easily, Call Me Irresponsible, and Time After Time. We'll listen back to an interview recorded in 1985. And world music critic Milo Miles reviews the music of African reggae star Alpha Blondy. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. Iraq says 21 people were killed during Western air raids today on targets within the southern and northern no-fly zones. The attacks came less than 24 hours after the U.S. fired 40 cruise missiles at what it said was an Iraqi nuclear facility. Mike Theodulu reports from Nicosia.
The latest Western air raids took place in broad daylight. 75 American, British, and French planes targeted anti-aircraft missile sites in the south of the country, which they failed to destroy last Wednesday. U.S. planes also struck at missile and radar sites in the northern no-fly zone after British pilots reported anti-aircraft fire there. The raids came as funerals were held for two women killed on Sunday when a U.S. cruise missile, apparently knocked off target, hit a Baghdad hotel. There were angry anti-American demonstrations in the Iraqi capital. Iraq claims 8 of the 40 cruise missiles were shot down, and President Saddam Hussein says he's giving big cash rewards to the successful gunners. To further boost his renewed popularity caused by the showdown with the U.S., Hussein is also increasing food rations for the Iraqi people. For National Public Radio, I'm Mike Theodulu in Nicosia.
The Russian government has expressed official concern about the Allied military action in Iraq. In a note to the State Department, Russia's foreign minister warned the United States not to attack Iraqi military facilities without the explicit approval of the UN Security Council. Andrei Kozarev said Russia especially regrets the casualties among the civilian population and expressed concern for the 100 or so Russian civilians who are now in Baghdad. Russia has blamed Iraq for the latest escalation of military action, but it also suggested that the United Nations make sure that the Gulf Coalition doesn't overstep its mandate. President-elect Bill Clinton had a day filled with symbolic events, and his transition operation got some more work done. NPR's Mara Liasson reports.
Clinton began the day with a jog along a portion of his inaugural parade route. He met with the diplomatic corps at his alma mater, Georgetown University, and celebrated Martin Luther King's birthday at Howard University. He had lunch with 50 people that he had met during the course of the campaign and whose stories about poverty, AIDS, or community service he had woven into his stump speech. The Clinton transition is also reported to have filled two more top State Department posts. According to transition officials, Mario Baeza, a Cuban-American lawyer from New York, has been named Assistant Secretary of State for Inter-American Affairs. The current head of the department's Latin American Bureau, Bernard Aronson, will stay on until Baeza is confirmed by the Senate. Clinton has also named Hattie Babbitt, a lawyer and the wife of the Interior Secretary-designate Bruce Babbitt, to be ambassador to the Organization of American States. In Washington, I'm Mara Liasson.
The Dow Industrials gained nearly 4 points today. This is NPR News. Bosnian Muslims have reportedly fired across the border into Serbia in a move that could extend the conflict in the Bosnian civil war. Serbia's Tanjug news agency said that Muslim troops fired across the Drina River into Yugoslavia for the second time in 2 days. The reports come as the self-proclaimed Bosnian-Serbian parliament prepares to vote on an internationally sponsored peace plan. The plan faces strong opposition in the hardline parliament because it would not allow a separate Serbian state in Bosnia, and it would force the Serbs to give up some conquered territory. The Russian government has announced measures to effectively lift the price controls that were ordered by conservative Prime Minister Viktor Chernomyrdin only 2 weeks ago. The decision comes after a debate among Russian and Western commentators who've criticized the controls as a rollback of Russia's economic reforms. NPR's Kathleen Hunt reports from Moscow.
The lifting of the controversial price controls, which were never even implemented, was discussed at a press conference today by the Russian government's economic strategist, Boris Fyodorov. He also presented a broad economic policy that appears to follow some key rules for the transition to a market system, such as plans to regulate the money supply to restrict inflation. The price controls were the first major policy move by conservative Prime Minister Chernomyrdin and drew praise from Russia's beleaguered shoppers. But economists here and in the West warned that controlling prices would only cut incentives for producers and goods would soon disappear from store shelves. The lifting of the controls partly represents a victory for the reformers left over from the government that launched Russia's painful economic reform last year with the initial liberalization of prices. This is Kathleen Hunt in Moscow.
Several British newspapers reported today that British Airways is planning to make another bid to buy part of U.S. Air. British Airways declined to comment, but a spokesman acknowledged that the airline is still holding talks with the U.S. carrier. I'm Corey Flintoff, NPR News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. One of the freshman members of Congress got his political education in the Black Panther Party. My guest is Bobby Rush, Democrat from Chicago. Rush co-founded the Illinois chapter of the Black Panther Party in 1969. The party supported revolution and armed itself to defend against racist attacks by police. Rush served as defense minister and also coordinated the party's Free Breakfast for Children program and free medical clinic. After the party broke up, he entered the Democratic Party. He was elected three times to Chicago City Council. In 1990, he was appointed deputy chair of the Illinois Democratic Party. Last summer, he was appointed director of the Democratic National Committee's drive to register people of color. The assassinations of President Kennedy and Martin Luther King were both turning points in his life. JFK's assassination inspired him to work for his country by joining the military. But he was up against racism in the military, and when King was assassinated, Rush went AWOL.
It was such an emotional and emotional turmoil that existed throughout the city and throughout the nation. And frankly, reporting back to the Army after Dr. King had been assassinated was the least thing on my mind. I felt a sense of total outrage. I didn't care. I didn't give a damn at that point in time about fulfilling, you know, my military obligations. And when I did finally return, they had court-martial proceedings initiated against me, but they decided that they wouldn't proceed with those, and because I was supposed to have been discharged anyway on the 20th of April, and Dr. King was killed on the 6th of April, on the 4th of April, rather. And so they gave me a discharge. I was discharged honorably from the military service.
What did you want to do with your life when you left the military?
Well, I knew that I was going to be committed to continue to fight in the civil rights movement, in the movement for social change. And when I left the service, I immediately began to organize the Illinois chapter of the Black Panther Party, along with Fred Hampton and others. And so I knew that I was going to be involved in the civil rights movement.
What appealed to you about the Black Panthers and about their very militant stand?
I think that the militancy is what appealed to me. Dr. King, his posture of passive resistance really did not necessarily appeal to me as a young African-American male who was raised in the inner cities and who, you know, was a part of the military and who was faced with the issues of police brutality and the issues that confront urban America. And the philosophy and the programs that was espoused more by Malcolm X appealed to me and to others of my generation.
Did nonviolent resistance seem too soft to you, or did you think that it wasn't going to be very effective in the North?
Well, I didn't think that it would be effective in the North, number one. And I thought that we were all searching for a sense of self-dignity, and passive resistance seemed to conflict with our sense of self-dignity and expressing our own self-dignity. Dr. King was a more spiritually directed, possibly, because he understood that it was a higher sense of, the way he explained it, it was a higher sense of expressing your dignity to be involved in passive resistance. But we couldn't accept that at that time. Police were systematically brutalizing and murdering black people and particularly young black males and getting away with it. And we didn't think that passive resistance was a way to deal with that. We felt as though we needed to be very, very militant in terms of our self-defense attitude and self-defense posture.
Fred Hampton was one of the Chicago Panthers, and he was killed in a police raid on his home. You were almost there, weren't you?
Right. Yeah, as a matter of fact, during that particular weekend, there was a retreat that we had in Chicago, and most of the leadership from across the state was here. And in fact, we had the leadership body was called the Central Committee, the Central Staff, and the Central Staff had a meeting, scheduled a meeting, and actually had a meeting on the night of December the 3rd, and we were supposed to have had a meeting that was going to last throughout the night, but at around, I guess, 11:30, other Panthers began to come into the apartment where Fred lived and where we were having a meeting, and we found that there wasn't enough space for all of us to sleep overnight, and so we adjourned the meeting in order to meet the following morning, and that's why we weren't in that apartment. But the police, the informant, they did not have up-to-date information in order to pass on to the police forces who were planning the raid. But Fred Hampton did stay in that apartment that particular night.
How did you find out that he was murdered?
Well, I got a call at about 4 o'clock in the morning from a Panther member who lived about a block away. And she said that something was happening in at the chairman's house because the police had barricaded the entire block, had cordoned off the entire block. And I made some phone calls, and I had asked someone to come by and pick me up. My driver came by and picked me up, and we went to this person's apartment, and we still didn't know what happened. We got we turned on the local radios, all night radio station, news station here in Chicago, and I guess about 6:30 that morning, the news came over that Fred Hampton had been shot and they had been killed, and that his body had been taken to the county morgue.
Then you went into hiding.
Not immediately. Once it became daylight, I went to the morgue to identify Fred's body, and the local media. We went to the apartment because at that time the police had retreated from the apartment, had left the apartment open, and so we had easy access to the apartment, and we went in and viewed the scene and determined that there had not been a shootout, that indeed Fred had been murdered. We call our legal team in and had some discussions with them and got information from surviving members people who survived the raid, people who were in that apartment the night of and the morning of and survived the raid, and was beginning to put together various pieces of information to find out what had happened. And so that day was spent for the most part gathering that information, and we had a standing policy then that if in fact we expected a raid or that indeed there was a raid, that the leadership of the chapter, particularly myself, that we would go underground. And indeed, that evening I did go underground. I was hid out on that particular evening, and at Father Clement's church. I can say that now. Statute of limitations has been over for many years, but Father Clement hid me out in the and the at Holy Angels Church.
Wasn't there a raid on your home while you were in hiding?
Yeah. The next, very next morning, the morning of December the 5th, the police department exercised what they considered was a, what they said it was a warrant to search my apartment for weapons. They came in, shot the door down, looking for me. And had I been in the home that evening, I would have been murdered. Also, me and my family. They indicated that that they found marijuana in my apartment, and upon further investigation, it was determined that the bag that they found these ingredients in, that bag contained bird seed as opposed to marijuana. So, but if I had been in that apartment, I would have been killed also.
So how did you come out of hiding?
I turned myself into Operation Push, to Jesse Jackson Operation Push on that following Saturday. I left Father Clements and I moved around from place to place. I didn't stay in one location too long, so I was on the move, and we made some arrangements through my attorney, Kermit Coleman, who and the African American Patrolmen's Association, Renard Robinson and Howard Saffo, we made arrangements to turn myself into Operation Push on that Saturday, because I knew that if I turned myself into the police, or if they caught me on the street, then I would have been killed. And so we turned myself in front of literally thousands of people on one of the regular Saturday morning meetings of Operation Push. And Reverend Jackson turned me over to the black commander of the old Wentworth District, Commander Bob Harness, and I was taken to jail and released on my signature.
Did you have to serve any time? Were you tried?
No,
what happened?
No. The charges was dropped because they really had no charges.
Right, were these the marijuana charges?
They found no guns.
No,
right.
Uh-huh.
And the marijuana turned out to be bird seed, so they had no charges.
My guest is Bobby Rush, freshman congressman and former Black Panther. More after the short break. This is Fresh Air. Just joining us, my guest is Bobby Rush. He's a congressman from the state of Illinois. He's speaking to us from Chicago. How did you get from being a Panther to deciding and opposing the system and knowing that there were a lot of people in the system who wanted to kill you? How did you go from that to deciding to run for office?
Well, in terms of the experience of the Panther Party, it was not the Panther Party always rejected the notion that we were somehow operating outside of the system. I mean, the Panther Party, they never did believe that we were in some type of state of Nirvana or state of aloofness, that we were somehow suspended outside of the system. We knew that we were a part and parcel of this system, and then in order to really effect change, we have to try to transform the system from within. So we rejected the notion that we're outside of the system, and so therefore we supported candidates, and ultimately Panthers began to run for offices. You remember back in 1968, Eldridge Cleaver ran for Vice President of the United States on the Peace and Freedom Party ticket. In 1972, Bobby Seale was in a runoff election for the mayor of Oakland, California. Take the Breakfast for Children program for granted. I mean, that's a very, very basic program that
right.
is within the system, feeding hungry children before they go to school. And as a matter of fact, the system co-opted it. And we knew that the system was going to co-opt it. That's why we started. So in terms of my own transformation, even though the Panther Party is no longer around, there's still basic attitudes that I embrace in terms of trying to be an effective force within the system. And when I decided to engage in politics, I knew that I could maintain a sense of commitment to changing conditions as it relates to poor people, as it relates to people who are suffering, as it relates to people who I serve, and that is not inconsistent. So nor is it some type of dramatic turnabout on my part to be involved in pursuing power. I mean, you know, we got to remember that I was a Black Power advocate in the '60s, and now I'm a part of a result of our attempts to achieve power for African Americans and giving African Americans the power to control the destiny of their community.
When you started to run for office, did the Democrats welcome you, or were they cautious or suspicious because of your Panther background?
Well, when I first ran, I ran in a nonpartisan way. The established status quo conservative reactionary Democrats didn't want me. Okay, didn't want to have anything to do with me, so I certainly ran as a young insurgent.
Obviously, you did become accepted within the party, became the deputy chair of the Illinois Democratic Party in 1990, and I believe it was in 1992 that you.
Well,
became...
I won't say, in terms of being accepted, I accept that particular definition, but I became the deputy chairman not so much because of any acceptance by mainstream Democrats. I represented a district which is the largest Democratic district in the nation,
right.
Certainly the largest Democratic district in the state of Illinois. The chairman, the individuals who were competing to become the chairman, they needed my vote. The person who I decided that I would support, I told him, I'll support you for chairman of the party, but in return for that, I want you to create a position, call it the deputy chairman, and I'm going to be the deputy chairman. So he agreed to that. So it wasn't an acceptance necessarily. They didn't reach out and say, okay, well, we're going to be good guys. We're going to accept. I mean, the reality was that if I didn't become the deputy chairman, then he would not have become the chairman.
I know one of the issues that has been important to you in your years in politics is crime in the housing projects of Chicago. Is there anything you feel that you could tell, say, young people in gangs now, young people in gangs who are selling drugs or using guns, about why they should stop? In your years of organizing, you know, having been a community organizer as a member of the Panthers, do you feel that you have any kind of special insights into?
Sure. I mean, the basic premise I would say is that there's no excuse for it. I mean, there is no excuse for it. There's no excuse for the drug proliferation, the handgun, proliferation. There's no excuse for the violence that's being conducted inside the African-American community. We can't blame any. There's nobody to blame except themselves. And the fact is that the African-American community as a community is becoming more and more intolerant of that type of behavior. Now, that's the premise that we have to begin with. Then secondarily, we can begin to try to address some of the other concerns. We know that there are internal conditions, there are external conditions that keep the African American community in a position of struggle, in a position of chaos, a position where we are not able to effectively address the American dream and pursue that American dream. Some of those internal conditions is a sense of a lack of order inside of our community. A lot of it's perpetuated by some of the young folks who have no respect for any kind of authority, no respect for any kind of law, respect for any kind of institution or anything like that. What we've got to do is begin to say, look, I mean, your condition is no worse or no better than anybody else's condition. You know, I can address them from a point of view of total truth in saying that I was, in my life, I was confronted with the same conditions, the same situation, all right, the same type of discrimination, the same bleak future, but, you know, instead of being a negative force on my community, I decided to be a positive force on my community, and I decided to engage myself in those activities that will push not only my community forward, but push me forward at the same time.
Because of gang-related murders that have happened in housing projects, there's been a series of police sweeps for arms and drugs in some of the housing projects, and I believe you've supported those sweeps. Do you have a lot more trust in the police now?
I think that the police institution, as an institution, is much more sensitive to the rights of all the citizens, much more sensitive to African Americans. We have more African Americans who are on police forces now. Some of them indeed are chiefs of police. There are officers within the police forces throughout the nation. And also the African American community is much more political, much more the power of the African American community in terms of local, state, and national politics is much stronger than it was in the past. And so, if a Daryl Yates, Gates rather, is the chief of a police force, urban police force, as he was in Los Angeles, and that police force acts contrary to the self-interest of the African American community or self-interest of the nation at large, then political pressure can be forced upon his superiors and the body politic to get him out of office, to fire him, to terminate his services. And that situation is similar in almost every city in this nation.
Tell us something of what your initiation into Congress has been like.
Well, it's been quite involved. I've been to at least four different orientations. Very, very honored to be in Congress. I look at the history of the institution. I look at people who, congressmen who preceded me, whose shoulders I stand on. I look at the potential and the possibility of what can be done in the Congress. And I'm somewhat astounded. I feel very, very good. I'm very, very excited about it. I'm somewhat weary of the different banquets and the balls and the various other kinds of pomp and circumstance that one goes through, I guess, every 4 years. But frankly, I'm ready to get to work now, and I'll be glad when the inauguration is finally over and the president sends this program over to the Congress, and so we can begin to work on the vital issues and the concerns of the American people.
Are you the first Panther in the U.S. Congress? First former Panther?
Yes, I am.
It's interesting that, you know, you and John Lewis, the founder of the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, mm-hmm. SNCC, are both in Congress now.
Yes, it is. Yes, John's and he's an excellent individual, and we have a lot of common history, and we have a lot of rapport. And John is one of my mentors.
Well, thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you.
Bobby Rush is a new Democratic member of the U.S. Congress. He spoke to us from Chicago. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Sammy Kahn was one of our most prolific lyricists, and every lyric had a story behind it. We'll hear some of those stories when we remember Sammy Kahn with a 1985 interview. Kahn died Friday at the age of 79. His many songs included All the Way, Time After Time, Come Fly With Me, Teach Me Tonight, and Until the Real Thing Comes Along. Reggae music is usually associated with Jamaica, but world music critic Milo Miles says, pay attention to the beat produced by Ivory Coast musician Alpha Blondie. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Ann Taylor. The Pentagon now says that it was a cruise missile that hit the ground outside a downtown hotel in Baghdad yesterday. Military officials say the missile was shot down by Iraqi anti-aircraft fire. The Pentagon calls today's raid on Iraqi radar and communication sites a success. NPR's Brian Nader reports.
Senior military officials told reporters today that the errant cruise missile was shot down by Iraq as it was heading for its target, a nuclear production plant south of Baghdad. Officials say the hotel was not a target, but was adjacent to the missile's flight path. Meanwhile, today's raid on Iraqi air defense radar systems in the southern no-fly zone finished up the job begun last week. Pentagon spokesman Pete Williams says Iraq can expect further attacks.
The sole factor that determines whether or not they're going to continue is the behavior of the Iraqi military and Saddam Hussein's government in complying with the UN Security Council resolutions and in not trying to interfere with coalition aircraft.
Williams says Iraq can avoid further attacks by ending its hostile actions aimed at coalition aircraft and by allowing continued UN inspections. This is Brian Naylor at the Pentagon.
Arab nations have criticized allied attacks on Iraq, but at the same time had not announced their support for Iraqi leader Saddam Hussein. The Arab League said it regretted a policy of military escalation against Iraq, but also called on Baghdad to respect Kuwait's independence. Moscow also criticized Sunday's missile attack on a suspected military facility and indicated its concern during talks with U.S. officials in Moscow. Up to now, Russia had been in favor of using military action to force Iraq to comply with U.N. resolutions. In Washington, the head of the NAACP joined city officials in marking Dr. Martin Luther King Jr.'s birthday with a prayer breakfast that emphasized hopes for better times with Democrats in the White House. NPR's Paz Cohen reports.
NAACP Executive Director Benjamin Hooks, the keynote speaker, said he'd been puzzled 25 years ago when Martin Luther King Jr.'s last speech warned of dark and difficult days ahead. Maybe, Dr. Hooks said this morning to laughter and applause, Dr. King foresaw 12 years of Reagan and Bush.
We have fought a 12-year battle to hold on to things that we thought we had. The Supreme Court seemed to have lost its cotton-chopping mind, and I'm convinced today that if you took the brains of the majority of the Supreme Court and put it in the bird's head, that bird would fly backward, backward, backward.
Hook said he and other African Americans now look forward to better times under the Clinton-Gore administration, but he also stressed we'll be watching to make sure they keep their promises. I'm Paz Cohen in Washington.
On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrials moved up nearly 4 points to close at 3,274. This is NPR News. President-elect Bill Clinton began his day by jogging up Pennsylvania Avenue. Later, Clinton spoke at Georgetown, where he earned his undergraduate degree, and then he attended ceremonies at Howard University in memory of Dr. Martin Luther King, Jr. At noontime, Clinton attended a luncheon for some 50 people who inspired him during his recent presidential campaign. At Georgetown, Clinton once again indicated his support of the Bush administration's policy in Iraq. Clinton stayed up until after 1 this morning because aides say he was working on his inaugural speech. Before that, he had met with General Colin Powell, chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, about the current situation in Iraq. Fugitive drug figure Pablo Escobar has vowed to resume attacks against the government of Colombia and given up the idea of turning himself in. Escobar sent a letter today to Colombia's highest-ranking judicial authority announcing a declaration of war. Leslie Werpser reports from Bogota.
Drug trafficker Escobar said he plans to carry out violent attacks by organizing a terrorist command called Rebellious Antioquia. Escobar claims widespread abuses by the Colombian police during raids against his lawyers and cohorts prompted him to abandon plans for surrender. The police, Escobar said, have committed torture, disappearances, and extrajudicial executions during their raids, which averaged 300 a day in the city of Medellin. While Escobar is not a reliable source on police conduct, the dismissal from the police force of 400 officers over the past 6 weeks is an indication that the institution is riddled with abuses. Police officers, however, have come under special violent attack in Medellin. 80 have been killed in the city over the past 4 months. Escobar said he would talk with the government if he offered the same conditions for peace negotiations as Colombia's left-wing guerrilla insurgencies. For National Public Radio, I'm Leslie Wurpsa in Bogota.
In trading today in Europe, the dollar moved down against other major foreign currencies. This is National Public Radio News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. The lyricist Sammy Kahn died Friday at the age of 79. He wrote so many wonderful songs, we wanted to remember him today. So we're going to hear a 1985 interview from our archives. First, a medley of just a few of his best-known songs.
I would work for you, slave for you, work my body to a grave for you. If that ain't love, it's got to do. Until the real thing comes along.
For me, if it's to shame, please let me explain. By me, if it's to shame, means you're grave.
Saturday night is the loneliest night in the week. Cause that's the night that my sweetie and I used to dance cheek to cheek.
Time after time, I tell myself that I'm so lucky to be loved.
Be my love, for no one else can end this yearning, this need that you and you alone create.
Did you say I had a lot to learn? Well, don't think I'm trying not to learn. Since this is the perfect spot to learn, trying to find somebody to teach me tonight.
When somebody loves you, it's no good unless he loves you. All the way, happy to be near you when you need someone to cheer you. All the way. Come fly with me, let's fly away. If you can use some exotic booze, there's a bar in far Bombay.
Call me irresponsible, call me unreliable, throw in undependable too.
If that ain't love, it's got to do. Until the real thing comes along.
Some of the songs we couldn't fit into that medley include Let It Snow, Three Coins in the Fountain, I Should Care, I Fall in Love Too Easily, The Second Time Around, and Love and Marriage. Some of America's greatest pop and jazz singers have recorded Sammy Kahn's songs. Several of his songs were written for Frank Sinatra. Kahn had his most successful and enduring partnerships with composers Saul Chaplin, Julie Stein, and Jimmy Van Heusen. Kahn wrote songs quickly and on demand for big bands, vaudeville, movies, and pop singers. Whenever he was commissioned to write a song for a particular singer, he would insist on performing it for them to show them what he had in mind when he wrote it. When it was time to demonstrate a song for a great singer, Kahn never lacked confidence, even if the singer was Frank Sinatra.
I sing the song for the first time, and I stand in front of Sinatra, and I am a lethal demonstrator. I'm lethal. I don't know if you understand the true meaning. When I stand in front of you and take my posture, I am ready. I know my part. And if you have any sense of words and music, first of all, I wouldn't stand in front of you to begin with unless I was ready. And I will say to you, we have the song for so-and-so. For instance, one of the most memorable moments of demonstrating songs is when I sang the songs to Our Town. Our Town for the first time. I'll never forget, we came and we sang to him. It was kind of around twilight time. I'll never forget, it was kind of quiet. With no one around, just him sitting in an easy chair. When Sinatra reflects, he rolled the bottom of his thumb over his lower lip. And that's how he reflects. And his highest praise is, yeah, yeah, high praise. And he doesn't turn down a song, never has.
Did he ever want to change a lyric that you wrote?
Only one time.
Which one was that?
That's in the song, one of my very, very favorite songs, The Last Dance. We started the idea of writing an opening song for an album and a closing song for an album, like Come Fly With Me. Opens with Come Fly With Me, of course, and the closing song, which is It's Nice to Go Traveling. So, and then we wrote Come Dance With Me. And then we needed a closing song. And we quickly discovered that Irving Berlin, the legendary Irving Berlin, I discovered that he'd written every song you can possibly write about dancing. Cheek to Cheek, Change Partners, I'm Putting On My Top Hat. So usually I write a song very, very swiftly. But here I am, and I can't come up with the last song. Finally, I turned to Van Heusen one day. I said, has there ever been a song called The Last Dance? And Van Heusen, who was very, very familiar with the literature of songs, said, no. It's been the Save the Last Waltz for me, but not The Last. I said, sit down. And I said, it's The Last Dance. We've come to The Last Dance. They're dimming the lights down. They're hoping we'll go. It's obvious they're aware of us, the pair of us, alone on the floor. But I want to hold you like this forevermore. So Sinatra is recording this song. And I had lines that they're wondering just when will we leave. But till we leave, keep holding me tight. Through the last dance, each beat of the last dance, and save me the first dance in your dreams tonight. So it, when you speak, you would say, they're wondering just when we will leave. You wouldn't say, they're wondering just when will we leave. So he said, they're wondering just when we will leave. I said, no, it isn't. If I hold it. I said, is there one, just when will we leave, but till we leave? He said, what kind of cockamamie word is... I said, no one speaks like that. I said, no. I said, no one speaks like that, but we aren't speaking, Frank, are we? We're singing, aren't we, Frank? And that's the only time we ever kind of good-naturedly quarreled about a line.
We're listening to a 1985 interview with lyricist Sammy Kahn. He died on Friday. More after this short break. This is Fresh Air.
¶¶ My guest is lyricist Sammy Kahn, if you're just joining us. Let's talk about some of the tools of the trade. You've written a rhyming dictionary. Did you actually use one? Would you ever use one when
I
you
always
writing?
Had a rhyming dictionary.
Yeah?
For the composer. That's the truth.
Really?
I always felt that if I couldn't think of the word, I shouldn't use it. But the composer used to say to me, every time I was writing, the composer used to say to me, you have a rhyming dictionary? I said, sure, here it is. Give it to the composer.
Right, I get it. Are there words that you really avoid because you know they're unrhymable?
No, every word is rhymable. Rhymable, rhymable. Take a simple name like Nicholas. You can rhyme it with ridiculous if you aren't too meticulous. You know, every word's rhymable.
Is there a song that you've written that you're proudest of the rhymes you were able to come up with?
Yes, the one I tell everyone, the one I'm very, very proud of is Call Me Irresponsible. Simply because I am wont to say, and it's not as facetious as it sounds, is that it has five syllable words in it. Call me unpredictable. Tell me I'm impractical. I said five syllable words from a fellow who came from a one syllable neighborhood.
You know what I love in that song? Throw in undependable too. I love the throw in. How did you get that?
It's
so vernacular.
Every song, as I say in the rhyming dictionary, every song, the title dictates the architecture of the song. If you say the title is Call Me Irresponsible, da 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 da, that's the architecture. Now, that song started off, Call Me Irresponsible, Call Me Undependable, Throw in Unreliable too. Do my foolish alibis bore you? While I'm not too clever, I just adore you. Call me unpredictable, tell me I'm impractical. Rainbows I'm inclined to pursue. Call me irresponsible. Yes, I'm undependable, but it's undeniably true. I said, you know, Jim, if I had unreliable down there, undeniable coming after unreliable would be better. So we switched the two lines on top. I call that neatening up a song. So we changed the two lines on top, so I would have, call me irresponsible, yes, I'm unreliable, but it's undeniably true. That's called graceful and very gratifying to the ear.
Do you think of your songs as having any Yiddish influence in it or Yiddish inflection in the lyrics?
I doubt it. What my songs have is a naturalness. You can call that anything you want, but I would not write a line that wouldn't be. If you pick up a song of mine, it will not stay in your mouth. It'll sing easily. Kiss me once and kiss me twice and kiss me once again. It's been a long. It'll flow out of your voice. It's almost like you'll be singing it almost without wanting to. Someone once thought they were, what's the word, putting me down, but paid me one of my rare compliments. The trouble with Sammy Kahn, he writes the way people talk.
Sammy Kahn, recorded in 1985. He died Friday at the age of 79.
Come fly with me, let's fly away. If you can use some exotic booze, there's a bar in far Bombay. Come fly with me, let's fly away. Come fly with me, let's float down to Peru. In Llama Land, there's a one-man band, and he'll toot his flute for you. Come fly with me, let's make it in the blue.
This is Fresh Air. Let's see what's coming up on All Things Considered. Robert Siegel's with us. Robert, what do you have on the latest bombing of Iraq?
Oh, we have a report from NPR's Anne Garrels in Washington, and we'll be talking with Michael McMillan of the BBC in Baghdad. Also with David Kaye, who was one of the UN inspectors for the International Atomic Energy Agency, actually, it was his employer, who was looking at various sites in Iraq, including the one that was targeted by more than 30 cruise missiles. He says that indeed was a dual-use site, could have been used for the military industry, the machine tools there, and was a good target.
Are you remembering Martin Luther King today?
We are. In fact, we are going to play the entire I Have a Dream speech.
Thanks, Robert. That and more on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. When Alpha Blondy began singing reggae in the Ivory Coast almost 10 years ago, he was inevitably compared to Bob Marley. World music commentator Milo Miles says Blondy hasn't become the next Bob Marley, but that's fine because he's become a style innovator and a charming performer in his own right.
In the 70s, Africa heard reggae's message of black unity and independence from the West loud and clear. Numerous stars, from Nigeria's Sonny Okosins to Zimbabwe's masterful Thomas Mapfumo, now include swatches of reggae in their repertoire. But Alpha Blondy is the performer with the finest ear for deep reggae grooves and the most ideas about new song subjects. There's a lot going on in a Blondy album. His soft, creamy voice swings through English, French, Diula, and bits of other languages. He professes to be a Christian Rasta as well as a Muslim. He studied English at Columbia University in the late 70s, took a side trip to Jamaica, and now divides his time between the Ivory Coast and Paris. Yet he understands that reggae crosses cultural lines easily enough to help him feel in tune wherever he is. International concerns are reflected in his songs. For example, he can make his slightly eccentric passion to unify the concerns of Israel and the Arab states into sledgehammer anthems.
From the Bible to the Quran, Revelation in Jerusalem, Shalom, Salam Aleikum. You can see Christians, Jews and Muslims living together and praying, Amen. Let's give thanks and praises. Baruch atah Adonai. Baruch haba Yerushalayim.
Following standout albums like Jerusalem in 1988 and Revolution in 1989, Blondy keeps expanding his program with his new album Masada. Blondy's politics can only be described as maximum well-meaning. He wants apartheid eradicated as part of helping people to feel at home around the world. And everyone should have the right to worship any way they choose. And no war, okay? But just because he's benevolent doesn't mean he can't work up a hypnotic, good-hearted number about his themes. Masada includes a batch of praise songs like God is One and warnings like Desert Storm and Peace in Liberia, and they've got enough bite and backbone for anyone. Even when he's mysterious and a bit eerie, you put up with him. Like in the title song, Masada, which concludes, Life is a Sacrifice. His band, known as the Solar System, includes his most supple four-man brass section. They're light and lithe with melody and give the rhythm section a lilt that suggests West African high life as much as reggae.
With the birds from the eels and clean up my sins. Wow.
the birds singing. I'm gonna walk up to the top of the rock of sacrifice, 'cause I know now life ain't no dice. Yes, I know now life is a sacrifice, and I know now life is a sacrifice. Witness the rising sun from Masada. Witness the rising sun now from Masada.
Masada's triumph, though, is the final track, in which the religious vision is painfully clear and moving. In a dream, Blondie sees Bob Marley's ascent up to what he calls his mystic resting place. Not only Rastas will nod sadly as Blondie keens over and over, why should black heroes die so soon?
Said I wake up with your rising sun, tears in my eyes, 'cause I heard that dreadful news. Bob Marley die, and I know my dread shall rise. Zion Lion just freeway to his mystic resting place. Why should black heroes die so soon? Why should black heroes die so soon? Why should black heroes die so soon? Why should them die so soon? Why should black heroes die so soon? Why should black heroes die so soon? Why should black heroes die so soon? Why should them die so soon?
With Masada in the competition, the best current reggae album comes from Africa, not Jamaica.
Milo Miles is a freelance writer based in Boston. Alpha Blondie's new album, Masada, is on the World Pacific label. Fresh Air's senior producer is Danny Miller. Our show is produced today by Fred Landerl. Our technical director is Joyce Lieberman. Naomi Person directed today's show. I'm Terry Gross.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting and by this and other NPR member stations. Additional support comes from the George Gund Foundation. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, the survivor of a shooting on meeting the man who shot him. We'll talk with Gary Geiger, who confronted his assailant through the Victim Offender Mediation Program. We'll also meet the mediator, Tom Christian. I'm Terry Gross. I hope you'll join us for the next Fresh Air.
Lucky jump.